got a place there.
In the UK? No. This is the first time they've had a basic program. So they've never had a master's program yet. It's okay, is it? Is it on then? Can you hear me? No, it's... can you hear me okay? Is it working? So we've taken refuge, so we don't need to do that, but then we should, or we could, you know, call to mind our particular negative actions that we wish to purify, and we want to purify all of them in general. So that's, refuge and then regret. You're not dwelling on and blaming yourself for your negative actions, of course, but you are just acknowledging them, just being, you know, business-like and practical about it, and then recognizing the fault, and then this is the remedy, and then afterwards we'll do a short time of trying to resolve not to do these negative actions again, and letting the virtuous deeds we've done, you know, this power of the perfection of wisdom, just purify our minds a little bit. That's the idea. Okay. So I regret all my negative actions, the heavy ones and the light ones, the recent ones and the ones in the distant past, the ones of body, the ones of speech, the ones of mind, you know, the ones I habitually do and the ones that I just have done occasionally, all of them. The breakage of the vows, breakage of the commitments to the Guru, and then general non-virtuous actions which harm other beings or are disrespectful to the holy objects. Especially, of course, the object, you know, the negative actions of the ones of immediate retribution, like injuring a Buddha, killing an Arhat, and so forth, you know, the really serious ones. And I regret those. Okay, let's read. Then Venerable Shariputra said to the Lord, "Lord, I too am confident and ready to explain the sense in which a Bodhisattva is said to be a great being." Okay. So that's your study of the middle way philosophy in depth, right? So that comes after Prajnaparamita. But at the same time, we're also studying a bit of Dharmakirti. You know, you heard of Dharmakirti? So he's a Buddhist specialist in logic. You know, he's like the person who's giving the Madhyamaka reasonings. They're not agreeing with his final view, but they're taking his explanation of reasoning as to be very sound, you know. So all our Galupa teachers say, you know, you've got to base your understanding as much as possible on reasoning. So where do they study reasoning and kind of, you know, those details? Most clearly is with Dharmakirti. Anyway, not to spend too much time on this. And then, so you study that sort of every 2 months every year. So you're studying Prajnaparamita or you're studying Madhyamaka, but you take 2 months off every year to study these, you know, Dharmakirti's explanations on logic. So that occupies you all about 10 years, that stuff. And then when you've done that, you can study a bit of Abhidharma. So that's going back to the earliest view, this Vaibhashika view, or view of the Great Exposition School. So that's a view that, you know, is prevalent in many parts of the world as a sort of Buddhist system. They do rely on that. You know, in the Pali tradition, they talk of the Abhidharma philosophy, you see, also available in Sanskrit. We study the Sanskrit versions, Vasubandhu's treasury of Abhidharma. But that gives you, you know, the complete picture then. So you've gone through all your, you know, perfection of wisdom, you tried your best with all that. But you want to be able to compare it, you know, look back at what other people in other parts of the Buddhist world might know. So you want to be able to connect with them, understand where they're coming from. And a lot of things in the Abhidharma, it's not like it's all rejected by the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, not at all. You know, all the sort of early school teachings on karma and stuff like that, you know, they're very largely accepted by the higher school. There's no change. So, you know, obviously things like the Four Noble Truths, you know, the basics are all there. So it's not something that is, you know, completely put aside. It's just sort of adapted. And you know, so you get a glimpse of Abhidharma. And then the last study for monks and nuns is the Vinaya, the discipline. So you have to know the monks and nuns' rules and, you know, how to sort of set up a monastery and how to do your purification of your vows and all the sort of etiquette of the interaction between monks and lay people. So that's just the, you know, just a quick glimpse of the study program as a whole into which the Ornament of Clear Realization fits, you see. Yeah, so as we mentioned yesterday, so the Ornament for Clear Realization is more taking the hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So it's the study of the meditational paths which lead to enlightenment. And then the Madhyamaka study, you know, like a guide to middle way by Chandrakirti, following on Nagarjuna's lead, that's studying the ultimate nature, the emptiness side. So that's how those two differ. And, so by the time you've done all that, you get a good idea of all those tenet systems which you've got on your paper. So, at the beginning you study the sutra follower system. Yeah? And then when you go into the middle way, with the guide to the middle way by Chandrakirti, you're going to be studying the deepest sort of consequentialist view, which is the middle way view considered to be the final view, you know, that what Buddha's taught to be deepest view that really will get you to Buddhahood, you know, meditating on that. But in between, you see, you've got the middle way autonomy school. Slightly different views, you know, according to Tsongkhapa at least. And in between those, you know, in the autonomy school, you've got the sutra middle way autonomy school, the yogic middle way autonomy school. So that's, and the mind only school itself, you see. So all those ones in the middle, the mind only school and the sort of lesser schools of the middle way, so those are the ones you study at the time of the Ornament for Clear Realizations, you see. So you say, well, why are we studying the Ornament for Clear Realizations and we're not studying from the highest view, you know, if you're sort of with me, following what I'm saying, why don't we study from the Prasangika view? Well, the kind of, you know, keeping the Prasangika view till you get to Guide to the Middle Way by Chandrakirti, So then you get the full-on consequentialist prasanga highest view. So in this Ornament for Clear Realizations, they want you to study some of those lower views and see how they shape, you know. Do they make sense to you? Or do they have any faults? Do they have limitations? Are they kind of not quite satisfactory? Although kind of very deep, not the deepest that you can go to, you see. And as it happens, you see, the main commentaries written on the Ornament for Clear Realizations by the Indian masters, so they recognize that Ornament for Clear Realizations is a very great text. It became very popular. Maitreya's writing, you know, Asanga's kind of communication of it. So then people like Vimuktisena and Haribhadra, so these are other Indian classic masters, so they write commentaries on the Ornament of Clear Realizations. So they write commentaries linking up the Ornament of Clear Realizations with the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So there's a commentary on the Ornament of Clear Realizations and on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, you know, both together. There are commentaries on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras which don't touch the ornament, you know, they're just on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. There's plenty of those. But then there are those commentaries which are explaining both the Ornament for Clear Realizations and the bits in the Perfection of Wisdom that it's relating to. Because they're very closely related, you know, everything in the Ornament for Clear Realizations is just related to something in at least one of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So those best commentaries that are really considered to be outstanding commentaries on the Ornament for Clear Realizations, most of those two that I mentioned anyway, Vimuktisena and Haribhadra, are from this yogic autonomy, middle way autonomy point of view. See, so it's very fitting that studying those commentaries, we just try to get the best of their view without worrying too much about the prasangic view. That's just to fill in a few details there then. Okay. Any questions? Anything you need explaining? So if you did the master's program in Lama Tsongkhapa Institute, you'd have to be studying a bit of Haribhadra, you know, a bit of his commentary. Very brief, so also quite difficult. You know, you don't get into these commentaries just jumping into a river and swimming across. It's like, yeah, really spend time and sort of fitting your mind to the way they are expressing things and puzzling things out. It's an intellectual endeavor, but, you know, it's all in this great project of acquainting ourselves with the perfection of wisdom as we've been doing this weekend. But yeah, they've got their challenges. But then you study the Tibetan commentaries, you see. So they make things a bit clearer. There's a commentary by Gyaltsab Jay, who's Lama Tsongkhapa's one of his direct disciples. So Gyaltsab Jay, when you see the three Lama Tsongkhapa and the two disciples, Gyaltsab Jay is the disciple with grey hair. So he's the he sort of gives the final interpretation by Tsongkhapa of the Ornament for Clear Realizations. Tsongkhapa wrote his own commentary on the Ornament for Clear Realizations, Golden Rosary. So that's translated into English by Gaurasparham, but you know, that's sort of some positions get slightly refined when you come to Gyaltsab Jay, some slight changes, but you know. And then you have the commentaries of your own monastery, you see, so they are the textbooks of your own monastery, so they're a little bit easier to follow, to make things, help you to get into the subject. But you can see, have you got all these layers? So it's like a really massive project to take all this in, right? So I find it quite tiring, quite taxing to do that, especially studying in a foreign language. So you haven't quite got the facility with the language that you'd like to have. So it becomes sort of a mentally challenging to get through it all. But I did my best anyway. What more can we ask? Forgotten a lot of it. But anyway. So, the name of the text, which you may not have got written in full, actually. Have you got the name of the text written in full on one of your papers? I don't think you have. Oh, yeah, that's it. Fine. Great. Thank you. So this is the root text as it is, you know. So the monks and nuns studying that properly in the Gelugpa system, they'll all memorize all these verses. They're written in sort of a 8-syllable line verses, is it? Or 7-syllable line verses, very short. Seven-syllable line verses in Tibetan, so you get through the verses quite quickly. Translating them to English, I had to go to 10 syllables and 8, you know, so the English ones have become a bit longer. But, you know, this I've only just done it superficially, so... In Tibetan, it seems to come out very nice, very beautifully. I don't know how much sense it makes, even in Tibetan, but... It's something memorizable and chantable anyway. So the full title you've got there in three languages right at the beginning. So you've got it in Indian language, because that's the language of the original composition, Sanskrit, of course. Everybody got one? Copy of this? Yeah. So this is presumably the latest FBMT Master's Program version. Siji is a lady, I think she was recently in Nalanda teaching the Master's, or helping with the Master's Program there. I think she's gone off into retreat now, but she's done a lot of translation. I don't know, everything's perfect here. They've done their best. We just got a sort of a flavor of it anyway, you know. You might, if you look at my translation, you might find it's a little bit different. Sort of, you know, but that's not necessarily a fault. It's just people are translating it with different understanding. So you may be translating according to the interpretation of, you know, the Sarajie, Jetsumpa textbooks. So there can be sort of slightly different, you know, readings of the Tibetan, because it's so condensed. And so, you know, you've got to fit everything into the lines, and they're just trying to follow the Sanskrit closely. Sometimes you're left wondering, does this sentence go with that sentence, or does it go with the sentence before? You know, you don't know exactly just from reading the verses exactly what it's supposed to mean, so you have to go to the commentaries. So it can be a bit of diversions. Maybe some mistakes, of course. You know, maybe I've made mistakes with my translation. I don't know. I was just in mind very quickly just to see if we could make it into a chantable form. So don't be surprised if there are some differences. And differences of terminology. You know, this is kind of just the way it's going to be. That different translators are going to translate things with different words. So we just have to manage with that. Abhi samaya alamkara nama prajna paramita upadishastra shastra. That's a Sanskrit, Tibetan. Sherigi parodo chimpe mengagi dencha ngapadopa genche jawa. When we were chanting, we'd even chant the title in a very long and sonorous way. In English, treatise of quintessential instructions on the perfection of wisdom, ornament for clear realization. So it's nice to have it in Sanskrit as a sort of a reminder of the original. So that's what they wanted to do, you know, just to show this isn't a text devised by a Tibetan composer, but it's from the Holy Land of India, the land of superiors. You know, written or given, sort of passed on, recited, you know, by the future Buddha Maitreya to Asanga, after he'd meditated for those 12 long years. So that's the future wheel-turning Buddha, who's Lama Sarpa is trying to encourage to come by building the statues and distributing statues of Maitreya and so forth. So it's him. Out of kindness to our Sangha, giving a sort of a preview of his future teachings. So with their great sacrifices and struggles, you know, the Indians to preserve this in, you know, land where there's, you know, the simple technology of printing things is not available. Everything has to be written out on palm leaf manuscripts. And then, you know, how the climate of India is, you know, they have these heavy monsoons. So you have termites, you have bugs which will eat these palm leaf manuscripts, they'll go moldy. Every 30 years or so, these manuscripts have to be recopied. You know, so you've got to copy them, and then that's all copied by hand. So, you know, mistakes are going to creep in. That's a problem too, you know, how copyist errors are going to sort of make the problem of a translation more difficult. And then the Tibetans come down into this hot and sort of humid land of India, and they're trying to learn sort of Sanskrit and get the meaning of these scriptures, but they're vulnerable to all kinds of diseases and health problems which they never have in Tibet. So they have to, you know, sort of a one 20 boys come down into India to study these things, and only one goes back, you know, Rinchen Sangpo, carrying these scriptures back to Western Tibet, for instance. You know, it shows how hard it was. And then in Tibet, you have they have printing, you know, they have printing with wood block. Every block is carved by hand. The paper's all made by hand. So again, you know, very expensive and time-consuming business. So we really have to appreciate the struggles that people went through to preserve these texts. Many of them got lost in Sanskrit when the Muslims invaded and monasteries got burnt and Buddhism kind of went out of fashion a bit. This one is available in Sanskrit. I never read it in Sanskrit. I tried to learn a bit of Sanskrit, but that's another matter. Anyway, so Abhisamaya, the first word in Sanskrit, is supposed to mean clear realization. Alamkara, that means ornament. Nama means named, you know, called. Prajna Paramita. So Prajna is an Indian word for wisdom. Paramita means something like perfection. Brought to completion. Upadesha, quintessential instruction, sort of, you know, the very pithy, like condensed text. Shastra, treatise. So not, if it was a Buddha's word, it would be called a sutra. You know, that's kind of a scripture, we might say. But anything else is a treatise, you know, something that is done by more human agents or less. But so is Buddha. There's a debate about whether Maitreya is a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, you see. When he gave this text, was he already a Buddha? Had he already become enlightened? Or is he still a Bodhisattva? So there's debates about that. Anyway, here it calls it a shastra, so that's a treatise, implying maybe it's not the word of a Buddha. Maybe the word composed with Maitreya being a Bodhisattva. Karika, so that's the word meaning verses. So in Tibetan, they translated it Sharadgi Parul de Chimpa. So that's their translation for perfection of wisdom. Parul de Chimpa literally means gone beyond. So their idea of conveying perfection, they didn't use a word they could have used for perfection. They chose this one, this idea of going to the other side, you know. So that's a very nice way of thinking about perfection of wisdom, isn't it? You're crossing the ocean of samsara, and finally you reach the other side. And that's your perfection of wisdom, when you've crossed over the ocean of suffering. That's kind of a good sort of a aspect of the Tibetan translation. Mengang is the instruction. Denchur, treatise. Ngumpur Tokpa, that's your clear realization. Gen is ornament. Shejawa is called. Tsingleo Chepa, so the verses and chapters. So anybody who's learned a bit of Tibetan? You studying a bit of Tibetan, Venerable One? Yes, good. Good to include that then. Yeah, so perfection of wisdom. So sometimes we have a more elaborate classification of perfection of wisdom, which we've already mentioned, some part of that. Here it says, in my notes, a classification into three. So there's the textual perfection of wisdom. So this is what we have been bowing down to. Then there's a path perfection of wisdom. So that's perfection of wisdom of those who are still on the learner's path. You know, they're still proceeding towards Buddhahood. So that's a path perfection of wisdom. Then a resultant perfection of wisdom. So that is a perfection of wisdom on the Buddha ground. Yeah. So if perfection of wisdom is divided terminologically, as we say, we debaters, perfection of wisdom is divided terminologically. Do we know what that means? By name, yes, but what does it mean? Do you remember, Stuart? I wouldn't quite say that.
Not necessarily an actual position, just giving names. So they may not classify them as things being divided.
Yeah, he's actually got the right idea, but you wouldn't quite hear him. So when we say it's divided terminologically, or by name or something, it means that. So you're going to give divisions, right? Classifications. So you've got perfection of wisdom there, then you've got things which fit into that category, right? So they're the divisions. So we've got textual perfection of wisdom, path perfection of wisdom, resultant perfection of wisdom. So they all get called perfection of wisdom. So in that sense, they're all perfection of wisdom because people like to call them perfection of wisdom. But strictly speaking, they aren't all perfection of wisdom. And strictly speaking, you know, so we're using the name, but strictly speaking, you know, they aren't actually. So it's like, you know, people might say a spider is an insect, yeah. Is a spider an insect? Is a spider an insect? It's not an insect because? Yeah, but why is it classified differently? So it must have some characteristics. Do all insects have two pairs of wings? What about an ant that is not a flying ant? You know, probably know more about it than me, yeah. No, I mean, I would say, an insect has got to have six legs. But
I think it's a wing number, it's three pairs.
Yeah. But a spider? Eight. But, you know, generally talking, we might say, all those things, you know, we'd include spider in insects just in general talk. But strictly speaking, it isn't an insect. So it's like that. So the textual perfection of wisdom isn't, strictly speaking, the perfection of wisdom. It's not wisdom, you see. It's just the written form of Buddha's speech about wisdom. Or the written form, the spoken form, you know, the spoken words of the Buddha, that is the textual perfection of wisdom. So the speech is still, you know, that's the textual perfection of wisdom. He spoke those texts. And then the path perfection of wisdom, you know, in the end, that isn't the perfection of wisdom either. If you remember in that definition I gave from Tsongkhapa yesterday, we did say that he includes the path perfection of wisdom in the perfection of wisdom, you know, the wisdom that is going to or has gone to non-abiding nirvana. But in the end, the Gelugpa tradition, I'm not sure why, they say, you know, it's better to keep perfection of wisdom specifically for the wisdom of the Buddha ground. Yeah. So out of those three, the textual perfection of wisdom, the speech or the, you know, the written text, and the path of perfection of wisdom as those people who are training, the bodhisattvas, and the resultant perfection of wisdom on the Buddha ground, you know, the perfection of wisdom in the mind of a Buddha, only that last one is properly speaking the perfection of wisdom, you know, in the final system of our school. So that's what we're really talking about when you're talking about the treatise on the perfection of wisdom. But of course, actually, this text is not just teaching about what's in the Buddha's mind, it's teaching about all the trainings and all the related clear realizations of your trainees, you know, your hearers and your solitary realizers and your Buddhas. So actually the text is talking about all of those, but just in the name, just to get to what perfection of wisdom actually means, you know, taped down, then only the one in the omniscient mind of a Buddha, only that is the perfection of wisdom. The others, you know, help to bring the perfection of wisdom about, so they're very related, you know, so it's giving the name perfection of wisdom to them, but that's not, strictly speaking, correct. Yes, then this is a quintessential instruction. So it's a treatise which is a quintessential instruction. So that implies a very condensed instruction, which gives you insight in sort of a condensed way. So it covers a whole topic, but it tries to just give you the essence, you know, just bring it all to, you know, just a very short statement. But of course, that might make it a bit difficult to understand. Anyway, he's saying it conveys the essential meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in very precise terms. So, and it enables an easy understanding of the meaning of these sutras, you see. So that comes up in the next verse. When we get to the verses, we'll look at that. And then what do we say about the clear realization? A clear realization is a path consciousness. So the treatise of quintessential instructions on the perfection of wisdom, ornament for clear realization. So clear realization, so something which means, you know, realizing directly, I think there, the best explanation. Not realizing with your conceptual mind or thought, you know, the indirect route of a thought consciousness which has to use mental representations, but direct realization, so your mind is just takes on the aspect of the object directly from the object. Well, what's the difference? Oh, is there a difference? Realizing through by means of a, you know, direct perceiver with the object appearing. So just the normal meaning of explicitly realized by a direct perceiver. I think, yeah, nothing complicated there. So these are the clear realizations there. Path consciousnesses, you know, path is a very, you know, that's the word they use. You get onto the hero path, you get onto the bodhisattva path, right? So that's when you enter the gateway of actually becoming a hero by developing this authentic renunciation. You're really determined to move away from the world, yeah? Really determined to leave cyclic existence behind. And this is a very deeply meditated, you know, ever-arising, strong sense of renunciation. So once you've developed that, you're on the path, you know. And then for the bodhisattva, it's that plus your determination of bodhicitta, which again is a very spontaneous mind, which is arising naturally. You know, you just see a sentient being and you say, I must get enlightened by that being. It spontaneously arises your wish to do that. So, that's a clear realization. It's not any old realization. It's a realization that's on the path. So it'll be in the mind of one of these beings who's, you know, properly training to be a hero or a bodhisattva or a solitary realizer. So that means that path consciousness is a cause of your enlightenment. It's like something which is leading you to liberation. It's not kind of, you know, dependent upon, you know, well, it's kind of, it's sort of really, you know, taking you there, going to liberation, going to Buddhahood. These are the direct realizations you need. Okay, now the ornament, he says, the last word he'd like to explain is the ornament. How do you get to this picture of the ornament? So ornament means something which beautifies, makes it more beautiful, or kind of brings out the beauty of the object. So the imaginative way this is explained by the commentators here, I think this is Gyaltsep Je who says this. He says, on the one hand, you can have a natural ornament. Secondly, you can have a beautifying ornament. And thirdly, a clarifying ornament. So he's just being very imaginative. So the natural ornament refers to a naturally beautiful phenomena, such as, you know, a beautiful woman. So he's naturally beautiful. So she's a natural ornament. Then the beautifying ornament refers to the decoration that brings out her beauty, or, you know, enhances it or highlights it. So that could be the jewels that the beautiful woman wears. So that's the beautifying ornament. So it makes the beautiful object even more beautiful. And then the clarifying ornament refers to that which shows or clearly reflects the beauty of the phenomena, such as a mirror that really that clearly reflects the woman's beauty. Or, I don't know, in modern times, because I don't know, a picture of her, a photo, or putting her on Facebook, a picture. Yeah, so more people can see it, clearly. So the clarifying ornament, so that's compared here to a mirror. So then the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, they're the natural ornament. They're like the beautiful woman. And then the topics of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which we're going to, you know, which are sort of distilled by the ornament for clear realizations. So those are the eight clear realizations and the 70 topics. So the eight chapters and all the topics in those eight chapters added up will add up to 70 topics. So they are the beautifying ornament. And then the the ornament of clear realizations itself is the mirror. That's the clarifying ornament. So the beautiful woman, that's the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. The jewel she's wearing, that is the eight clear realizations of the 70 topics. And the mirror in which she's reflected, you know, the way she's the sort of projection of her, so that everybody can see her. You know, that's the ornament of clear realizations. The text itself. That's the topics that are the subject matter of the text, which are, as we'll see, eight clear realizations and 70 topics. So there's eight chapters, and you add up all the topics of the chapters, five here, seven there, and so forth, you get 70. So those are the beautifying ornament. So that's just an imaginative description or, you know, portrayal by, I think, Gyaltsep Je in his commentary. So basically, the ornament of clear realizations is there to clarify the perfection of wisdom, you know, to make a clear, kind of give a clear picture of it. And then, you know, what it's bringing out, what the high points of it, the beauties of it are you know, if you condense them down, you've got the 8 clear realizations and the 70 topics. So that's what's really being, you know, illuminated. That's what really stands out as the, you know, the beauties of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So this time last yesterday, we did have a morning meditation, but things have got a bit late today. We did have a bit of longer meditation to start with in the morning, didn't we? So will we just carry on till 1 o'clock? With a bit more of the looking at the text. But afternoon we want to have a meditation. We'll do our meditation this afternoon. We'll have get into groups again. But we'll explain what we do after lunch, I think. So you've got to compose a meditation today. So we'll do that after lunch. We'll get together in here at 2:15 and explain that. Okay. So the next line, it says, "Homage, I pay homage to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas." So that's not written by Maitreya or Asanga, that's written by the Tibetan translators. So what does that signify? Yes, there is a specific thing you can read from that what aspect or what basket of the Buddha's teachings is this? Does this teaching? Does this text relate to? So when the Tibetan translators put in that, "I prostrate to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas," then it tells you that the subject matter of the text is the sutra basket. You know, the meditational paths and concentrations, which are typical of the sutra basket. If they bow down to Manjushri, then it means wisdom. It's in the wisdom section. So this isn't in the wisdom section, it's in the meditational paths and, you know, the sutra section. And if they bow down to the omniscient mind of a Buddha, so then that means it's in the Vinaya section, in the morality, ethics section. So this is just a convention that the Tibetan translators followed, you know, because these translations were being done under royal patronage. See, it was a kind of a government project to translate the text like this into Tibetan. It was sort of that's how it was. They were able to do it because it was funded at the highest level by the, you know, government of the time, and so there were these sort of, you know, traditions and instructions and things that went out. So people are translating had to follow these conventions. So if you're prostrating to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, yeah, so you want your aim in that is to, you know, hopefully get, you know, add one more sort of favorable condition for you to be able to finish the text and translate it properly. And then, you know, in doing that, get yourself and other beings to enlightenment. You know, that's the ultimate goal, bringing enlightenment and liberation nearer. So that's the reason for prostrating, but then the convention is just to show what kind of text you're writing. So this is in the sort of sutra department. So that's the homage of the translators. Now the first verse is 1.1 in our numbering scheme. This is the homage of the of Maitreya himself. So I don't know where my translation's gone. Yeah, so in verse number 1. "Who has the knower of all is she who leads the hearers seeking peace to utter peace." who, as the knower of paths, makes those who work the good of beings achieve the world's welfare, and well endowed with whom the sages teach on this all-aspected variety. I bow down to the mother of the Buddha and the hearer, Bodhisattva companies. So this is the homage. This is where, you know, you're offering your sort of prostration. And then the next two lines, the next two verses after that, are expressing the purpose of the text. So really, you can say the first three verses are part of the introduction. And then chapter one proper begins at verse. Well, that's not true either. No, don't say. I won't say that. But that's anyway. Just. Homage, the next two verses express the purpose, then the next few verses after that are the sort of condensed presentation of the, you know, the whole meaning of the whole book. So the first chapter, strictly speaking, doesn't begin until verse 19, Mind Generation. So on my paper, page 2, Mind Generation, that's the first verse of the actual first chapter proper. So the first 18 verses then are all part of what you can say introduction. So that's not clearly marked out in the Tibetan text, but that's how we should understand it. So the homage is a very famous, very kind of much sort of holy, sacred verse or something that you hear when the Dalai Lama's teaching. They may often recite this verse just as one of the preliminary verses, just on its own as a kind of a auspicious kind of recitation. So who or what is Maitreya paying homage to? Well, it becomes clear, or it's I don't know about clear, but he's specifically saying it in the last two lines, isn't he? So in Tibetan, your subclauses always come first, and the main verb always comes at the end of a sentence. In Tibetan, in English, it's often the other way around. You can put your main verb first and all the subclauses afterwards. But sometimes, for effect, it's good to keep your last verb, your main verb, to the end, isn't it? You know, when you're composing a verse, to have some impact. So he says all he wants to say, then he says, I bow down, you know. To the mother of the Buddha. So that's the perfection of wisdom, you see. In reliance on her, all your superior beings take birth. She's a mother in the sense that she's the one who makes it all happen, you know, that we can say empowering condition. So we say she's the mother of the four superiors. So by now we perhaps know what the four superiors are. Maybe not, but doesn't matter. When you look at this paper, the four superiors are summarized. Yeah, so we'll come and look at it on this paper afterwards. So, anyway, what are the four superiors? Anybody tell me? Yes? Yes, thank you. Brilliant. Right. Celebrate. Yeah, and just for the heck of it, what is the criteria for being a superior? Yes, madam? Would you like to have a go?
It would be when you reach one of the paths,
Yes, I don't quite pinpoint it. Which path do you have to reach to be a superior? We haven't mentioned these five paths yet, but we'll have to maybe, you know, next weekend. Path of seeing, yeah. So that's putting them on slotting them in onto the league table sort of thing, you know. But what internal quality do they have to deserve that slot? Yes. So does one of these hearers have to directly realize emptiness to be a hearer superior? We are. But how do they reach the path of seeing? What jumps them up there? They can't just say, oh, I'll go to the path of seeing now. I've had enough on the path of preparation. I'll just have a stroll up there, see what it looks like. They've got to achieve something. No, renunciation is where you come in at the bottom end. That's, you know, that's the first get the door open. Path of seeing is a bit higher up. Yes, but yes, that's not quite, doesn't quite pinpoint it. Realizing its advantages is better, but I would have thought somebody of the sharpness of Steffi would get even closer to the actual. Yeah, you have to realize the selflessness as of your vehicle. And if you remember what we were saying yesterday, that these hearers don't realize, you know, this sort of emptiness of true existence, which is, you know, so praised so highly in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. That's the bodhisattvas who've got to realize, you know, get to Buddhahood. They need the power of realizing, you know, emptiness of true existence. But the solitary realizers are just going to their own individual liberation. And the hearers were just going, you know, to the individual liberation. They could realize emptiness, it's not impossible, but they don't have to. They realize sort of this lesser kind of selflessness of persons. Yeah? But that's their, you know, when they realize that directly, yeah? Not just through reasoning and thought and using their inferences and reasoning, which is all very important. But it's only when you get this direct realization, you do away with thought altogether. Your mind is sort of directly realizing emptiness, just like I'm directly seeing white with my eye consciousness now. Yeah, so we'll come to that. This is just, you know, just prefiguring what we've this kind of things we've got to take on board. So those are the superiors. So those are persons who, you know, They seeing the way it is to the point where just by meditating then on that, you know, main object, that is their antidote to what they're trying to overcome. They're trying to overcome those imperfections of mind which I was talking about in the preliminary meditation today. You know, all that junk you've got in your mind which you've got to, you know, boot out, and then, you know, you are. Your mind is the perfection of wisdom. All that kind of, you know, the imperfections, the sort of pollution, whatever you want to call them. So we can talk about the afflictions. We can talk about the kind of the negative passions we have. The attachment, of course. And then the ignorance that allows that attachment to get going. It doesn't get going unless you've got a bit of ignorance about the way you are, the way you exist. So that ignorance, you've got to kick that out, and not just the ignorance manifests, but the seeds of the, you know, any trace of the ignorance in your sort of, you know, like any weed, like the weeds, you can weed away the weeds from your garden, but if the seeds are still there of other weeds, you know, they just come back again. So you've got to get rid of all those seeds as well, and then you're not going to have the sort of the unwanted weeds. Your mind is sort of completely clear then. And then for the bodhisattva, there's a bit more to do, you know. You've got to get rid of the obscurations to omniscience, which is another set of obscurations, not just the afflictions. Yeah? So there's an object of abandonment, the things you've got to overcome. What you're going to overcome it with is your realization of your ultimate truth of your particular vehicle, you see. So when you've got that antidote, you know, that direct realization, that is your antidote. That is the wisdom that will burn away, clean away all these imperfections in your mind. So when you've got that antidote, you know, directly seeing it, that's when you're a superior being. That's when you're a noble being. The four noble truths, it means the four truths are the noble ones, the superior beings. So they're the ones that realize the truth directly, you know, so they deserve to be called noble ones. So they're truths, the four truths are the truths of the noble ones, because they've seen them directly, you know, they really kind of got the complete hang of it. But ultimately, you know, whether you're a hearer, or whether you're a solitary realizer, or whether you're a bodhisattva, whatever path you're on, it's the perfection of wisdom that is, you know, making it all possible. Because the perfection of wisdom makes the Buddha possible, and the Buddha knows all the paths, you know. And then that, so it's all coming from the perfection of wisdom. Even the sort of knowledge that the hearers acquire, it's all coming from the Buddhas and the bodhisattvas who do the teaching. So it all meets back to the perfection of wisdom. So the perfection of wisdom is the mother of all those. Okay, so that's just the last two lines, isn't it? But we've got the other, you know, the other part of the bit more to explain yet, going to them individually. But we stop for lunch. And I think after lunch we should prepare our meditation, because that's a good time after lunch, get into our groups and work on our meditation on bodhicitta, yeah? Then we can come back to this if we have time. How many groups were there yesterday? Just four. Okay. So if you can get the board up, Jason. Right, stop there. Meet again then.